What we, to my mind, we have to be very clear about is how we can accord that life in the womb, perhaps the respect that we would want to give it, but at the same time, we don't want to take anything away from the moral status of the woman who is carrying it because of who she is and the nature of her life. The relationship that the embryo has as being in her womb. I think that the woman has the greater claim to moral and indeed physical integrity. And that's the thing. It would be wonderful to accord them both the same moral status and moral value. But the point is that you simply can't.
I believe that all humans are equal, and that is my starting point for this debate, and that includes the human being in the womb. And I think we have to say that all of them are exactly equal in terms of their value, their rights. Now, sometimes rights can conflict, you know, so my right to do what I want might conflict with your right to life if I want to end your life. Now, normally we would judge in favor of you in that situation. We would say, no, I can't end your life just because I want to. And that's not to say that you're more valuable or you're more important or that we're unequal. It's to say that we are equal as human beings, but that the right to life is a more fundamental and basic right than my right to choice.
You are listening to Premier Unbelievable, the show with the tagline Faith Explored that aims to get you thinking. I'm Ruth Jackson, and today on Unbelievable, we are focusing on the abortion debate. Our discussion centres around the rights of the unborn child, the rights of women, pro-life, pro-choice, when does life begin? Unbelievable aims to get Christians and non-Christians thinking about a variety of questions, and these complex ethical issues are no exception. Today, Roger Bolton, veteran BBC broadcaster, is joined by writer and reproductive rights of women advocate Anne Faraday, and is discussing this topic with Dr. Callum Miller. Callum is an NHS medical doctor and a pro-life advocate, and he will be putting forward a Christian viewpoint arguing for the moral value of the fetus. Let's join them now.
Hello and welcome to Unbelievable, the show that gets Christians and non-Christians, we hope, thinking about topics that matter to all of us. And today we're talking about one such subject, abortion, a debate about life, equality and choice. My guests today are Anne Faraday, British author and reproductive rights activist, who's been involved in the field of abortion and contraception for 30 years. Her book, The Moral Case for Abortion, A Defense of Reproductive Choice, sets out the moral arguments for a woman to decide about the outcomes to her pregnancy. And she was also, by the way, the former CEO of the British Pregnancy Advisory Service, which is the largest abortion provider in the UK. And also with us is Dr. Callum Miller, an NHS doctor and pro-life advocate. He graduated from the University of Oxford Medical School in 2015, currently works as a medical doctor in the UK. And he also teaches philosophy at the University of Oxford, where his research focuses on abortion policy in practice. And he also holds a master's degree with distinction in biblical studies. And I have to say, Callum, you're so young, I can't believe you've managed to do all those things in the time available. But congratulations anyway. Now, let me ask a provocative question of you, Anne Faraday, before we start. Have men any place in this debate? I mean, has this elderly white man any right to talk about this issue?
Of course men have a place in the debate. Firstly, because men are thinking creatures, at least most of them are, and have opinions on these things. But also, when it comes to pregnancy, they're involved in the pregnancy. It's just that the pregnancy doesn't end up in their body.
But your view is that the decision, ultimately, about abortion, if you believe you have the right to have an abortion, is essentially one to be taken by a woman.
I think it has to be because the pregnancy does reside in her. And so to me, the idea of compelling a woman to have an abortion that she doesn't want is absolutely abhorrent. And similarly, the idea of compelling her to continue a pregnancy that she doesn't want also doesn't really sit easily in my mind.
Well, before we start getting on to some of the ethical and biblical issues involved, can I look at the question of numbers? I mean, the latest numbers I've seen for 2021, just for England and Wales, are almost 215,000.
Mm-hmm.
215,000, the highest since records began. The highest number there is for women aged 22, I think. 82% of them are single women, and the highest numbers are in the Northwest. So this is just for England and Wales, but abortion has never been high. Why do you think that is?
I honestly think it's because we become very accustomed in our society to deciding when we have children and how many children we have and with whom we have them. And although more women use contraception in Britain than ever before, it's not always infallible. We also fail to use it. And I think women have come to see early abortion, at any rate, as a backup to contraception. And they tend to see it as more of a continuum. So I think that's why, despite a lot of attempts on the part of policymakers to try to drive numbers of abortions down, it hasn't really worked. It's needed.
Well, of course, Callum Miller, I think, takes a rather different view. Dr. Miller, can I ask you about the numbers before we get on to the biblical issues, which I want to explore with you now? But just before that, do you have any explanation for why the abortion rate, certainly in England and Wales, is increasing, has increased to its highest level?
It's a little bit difficult to explain why it's continually increasing, not least because this appears to be a slightly different trend to other countries. So, for example, in the United States, when abortion was legalized, there was a massive, massive rise to, I think, nearly 2 million a year at the very beginning. And then it's been gradually decreasing since, you know, the last couple of decades. Whereas in the UK, it seems to have just been a pretty steady rise pretty much since 1967. Of course, probably a significant part of it is just that the population keeps getting bigger. Otherwise, it's honestly quite difficult to say. You know, we know that it's a common event. About one in three women have an abortion in their lifetimes. About one in four pregnancies ends in abortion. And so this is something that to a degree has been normalized, something that is, I think, still seen as a source of not regret in the sense of I wish I didn't have it, but regret in the sense of I wish I didn't have to have had this by women. I think most women still see this as something that was, in that sense, regrettable about their lives. But nevertheless, unwanted pregnancy is extremely common because a lot of people have a lot of sex and sex is a common part of human experience. And as Anne
really
said,
the thing, astonishing thing to me about this by now, I mean, we had the pill since about 1965 or 66. I think I was at the University of Liverpool at the time, so I do remember the date. And we still have this problem, which is extraordinary. But anyway, let's leave that aside and go with you, if we may, to what, for most Christians, is the first question to ask on this, is what does the Bible say about abortion? And it doesn't say a lot, it seems to me. It says life is a gift from God, but does it say more than that, Callum?
So I came to my pro-life views not because of anything the Bible taught, but because I think this is an issue of human equality that science has a lot to say about. When I did come back, you know, having been convinced from the scientific and philosophical arguments, the Bible may not speak directly about abortion. It may do. There's actually some controversy about that when you look at the text in a couple of passages. You can often tell someone's perspective on the embryo or the fetus, at least, and usually on their perspective on abortion, by looking at how they speak about the embryo or fetus.
In fact, I do want to come to this, but I just want to establish the extent to which we can seek from the Bible significant guidance on this issue, because it seems to me that the general statements are there in Genesis and Psalm 36, for example, about life being a gift for God. It's precious. And there are references to defending the life of a child in the womb. And so if someone intentionally kills an unborn child, parts of the Bible suggest that would be murder. So we're extrapolating from some of the earliest books in the Bible and so on. But there are specific references to the killing of the unborn child or the fetus, and there are penalties for that, and that's looked down in the Bible as being, if not murder, very close to murder. Isn't that true?
Yes, exactly. You can look at someone's perspective on the embryo or the fetus largely by how they talk about it. And the Bible tends to speak of it as an infant. And so, for example, it uses the same Greek word brephos for the unborn child John the Baptist. And it says that that unborn child John the Baptist leapt in the womb for joy at the coming of Jesus. The exact same word brephos in the Greek was used of the newborn baby Jesus, and then even of the little children that were brought to Jesus when Jesus says the kingdom of God belongs to these. And so there's a lot more that it does say, but I suppose the Bible fundamentally sees a complete continuity between the child before birth and after birth. It talks about them in the same way. It says that God has a plan for them before birth. It says that they are to be protected before birth and so on. And so the general perspective of the Bible is one of continuity between the child before and after birth, which I think of course, has immense implications for this topic.
And just briefly on the argument we're going to come on to now and come to Anbit is about when life begins, when you consider life begins. But I think that obviously Roman Catholics, for example, would be that life begins at the moment of fusion between the sperm and the egg, wouldn't they? Whereas I think some Muslims would argue that the spirit enters a little later, various number of days and so on. Is that right?
Yeah, so for me, this is a scientific question. I mean, the Bible doesn't mention fertilization because they hadn't discovered fertilization at that point. And so the reason that you began to get statutory abortion bans in the Anglo-Saxon world, in America and the UK in the 19th century, was not because they had suddenly discovered a book of the Bible or because the Pope suddenly declared that it started at fertilization. It was really because the scientists in the previous century had discovered fertilization. They had discovered the beginning of life. And so they said, look, we've always had this perspective and this principle that life has to be protected from the very start. But now science has shown us when it actually begins. And therefore, it was primarily doctors that were leading the charge against abortion in the 19th century because they said, now we've discovered fertilization. This is when we have to be clear life begins and the point from which we should protect.
Although it should be fair to say that in Britain, the medical profession is split on this issue. There's no unanimity. It hasn't actually, this Royal College of Surgeons thing, has deliberately not taken a decision on this because it's so split.
Now, yeah, so originally the doctors were pretty uniformly against it, whereas now I'd say it's not even so much they're split, there's a large majority that are for abortion choice. So I would be in the minority in the 21st century.
Can I come across then to Anne Faraday and talk about this central question, which is about when life begins? As we've heard, for some people, it begins from the moment of conception. How would you address that question?
Well, actually, I'd probably agree with Callum on it. For me, life begins in the womb at conception. I think it's very, very difficult to make a rational scientific argument against that. It seems to me that it's a conception that you get something that is unique, that's not just, you can't simply dismiss it as being simply a part of the woman. It has its own DNA and obviously, as Callum says, there's a continuation from that very, very early embryo through to the late gestation fetus through to after birth a newborn. So, and I have a huge presumption in favor of human life as it happens, even human life in the womb. But
do you give different values? Do you give different values to life?
I do.
And how do you determine the sort of gradation of values between starting at the moment of conception and arriving in the world as a baby?
Well, and here is one of these things where life is so much more messy than philosophy in many ways, because I think that the problem that we have with that early life is that it is in a woman's womb. And what we, to my mind, we have to be very clear about is how we can accord that life in the womb perhaps the respect that we would want to give it, but at the same time, we don't want to take anything away from the moral status of the woman who is carrying it. And it seems
But just on that point, if we therefore in the future, if science in the future, and there's some signs that this might be possible, is able to take the fetus at a very early stage and develop it outside of the womb and outside of the woman's body, would that change your attitude?
Well, let me put it like this. I cannot see anything that would change my attitude to the dominant value that I give to the woman's position in this. So if science can do that, and that is what the woman wants, and with her consent, then that's absolutely marvelous. But the
So what you're arguing here is about, if I may say so, is both, in your view, the mother and the fetus or the unborn child, as some would call it, have rights. But in your view, the mother, until the moment of delivery, has, if you like, greater rights. Is
well,
that your view?
I'd rather not use the word rights. I'd rather use the word at this stage that both of them, I think, have a moral status. But I think that the woman, because of who she is and the nature of her life and the relationship that the embryo has as being in her womb, I think that the woman has the greater claim to moral and indeed physical integrity. And that's the thing. It would be wonderful to accord them both the same moral status and moral value. But the point is that you simply can't. And
can I come across to Callum then on this point? You seem to both agree when life begins, but Anne is talking about, well, not an argument over a dispute over rights, but giving greater preference to the mother's position. Is that something, Callum, you agree with or not? Or is it your view that both have, I won't say equal rights, but both have rights, if you like, and that the one does not trump the other?
Yeah, so I should say that Anne and I probably agree on most things, not just when life begins, but actually the conversations we've had in the past. We have a great deal of agreement, and so I've been very grateful for her friendship over the last couple of years. I suppose where Anne sees the necessity of sort of inequality between them, I suppose I don't see the need to judge that one of them is in a sense more valuable or to be prioritized. So I believe that all humans are equal, and that is my starting point for this debate, and that includes the human being in the womb. And I think we have to say that all of them are exactly equal in terms of their value, their rights. Now, sometimes rights can conflict. You know, so my right to do what I want might conflict with your right to life if I want to end your life. Now, normally we would judge in favor of you in that situation. We would say, no, I can't end your life just because I want to. And that's not to say that you're more valuable or you're more important or that we're unequal. It's to say that we are equal as human beings, but that the right to life is a more fundamental and basic right than my right to choice. I don't mean to trivialize abortion in the sense that it's just a whim, but that's how we sort of frame the debate here.
But surely as a doctor, you will have been faced in a situation where a pregnant mother is seriously ill, there's a real problem in the womb, and you have to choose between preserving or attempting to preserve the life of the mother or the fetus or baby in the womb. And my understanding in the past has been that in those circumstances, the mother is given preference. Is that not true? So that implies that the mother has greater rights.
So I think these situations are very rare. And normally you can only save the mother and the baby will pass away either way. Because if the mother dies, the baby will also die as a result. So it's extraordinarily rare, really probably just a handful of cases a year at most, in the UK, where you would get an actual choice between the mother and the child. I think in that case, you can justify delivering the baby, knowing that it will pass away, not because you intentionally want to kill it, but essentially as a sort of self-defense on the part of the mother. This, of course, is a tragic situation. We wish that we would never have to end someone's or anyone's life in self-defense. But I think in those situations, because it is the baby that is posing a threat to the mother's life, then as regrettable as it is, and it's of course her choice in that situation, I don't think she must be forced to deliver the baby, But if she wishes, then I think she would have a legal right to self-defense in that situation, which tragically for everyone, including her, would lead to the baby passing away. But again, I think that's compatible with recognizing that both of them are fundamentally equal. It's just that the situation allows us to treat them differently.
Can I now then, if you're both agreed about when life begins, and you both agree that in a way you don't, well, I think we don't want to get an argument about who has the greater right, but both mother and child, or mother and fetus, have rights. Can I ask whether how different this debate is now than it even was, say, 30, 40 years ago, in terms of what we now know about what is going on in the womb? What we know about the ability to experience pain, what we know about the ability of a premature baby to survive outside the womb. And can I ask you about that? Whether your view has been in any way affected by those sort of, I feel like, scientific increases in knowledge?
Well, to be honest, I think almost the tragic thing is that we haven't seen more fundamental increases in knowledge. In fact, if you look at the ability to keep very premature babies alive, it has not advanced in great strides. And that, of course, is an absolute tragedy for women who have premature babies and who want them to be alive. I think that perhaps too much emphasis is placed on an increase in knowledge, because I think fundamentally, when we look at this question and when we look at the position of women who are making decisions about their pregnancy and indeed doctors who are treating them, women have always known that what they carry in their womb is a potential child, and they know that what it looks like in the later stages of pregnancy is like a baby. And in fact, probably I would say that women imagine perhaps the fetus or baby in the womb, call it what you'd like, probably knows more or experiences more than it maybe even does, but it doesn't stop them from making that decision. And the reason for that is because when it comes to these later abortions, I would argue that women do so only when they feel themselves really driven to that. And I think that it's wrong to imagine that women have done so in ignorance. Where technology...
I'd like to pick up that the next part of our conversation, if I may go back to Callum Miller on this. If we can look to what science has told us, it clearly has told us that children can survive outside of the womb with a great deal of attention and with perhaps significant problems in later life at a much earlier age than we thought. I mean, we do hear now 24, 22 weeks, don't we? And that it's possible to survive, although I say there are questions in the longer term. What have we learnt, though, about, or do we know about the fetus's or the unborn child's ability to feel pain and when that happens? Because this troubles a lot of people. If we can just keep it now to the medical evidence now and how much that will influence the debate.
Yeah, it's inevitably difficult to say with certainty because they can't speak to us and tell us they can feel pain. And so clinicians and researchers look at all sorts of different markers. They look at what neurological or neuroanatomical structures does the fetus have. They look at what hormonal response it gets when you inject it. Does it cry at later stages of pregnancy? It cries in the womb when it has an injection, and a variety of other things. And so it's difficult to say with certainty. Some people will say 24 weeks at the earliest. Some people used to say at least even up to birth. In fact, some people used to say the baby, if it's newborn, doesn't feel pain until it's a year old or so. The most recent research by Stuart Derbyshire, who's pro-choice but a world expert in fetal pain, suggests that it might be possible from as early as 12 weeks, because they've realized, actually, firstly, that the baby has sort of comparable structures to the adult brain at just 12 weeks. And also, some people have cast doubt on whether you need the cortex, which is kind of the wrinkly outside bit of the brain, to actually feel pain. That is actually become more under fire recently. And so he thinks it could be possible from 12 weeks, which would be 10 weeks after fertilization. Some people think it's earlier, like 7 weeks. Other people think it's 24 weeks. I would say probably from 12 weeks, we can be confident it probably feels pain, but we can never know with absolute certainty.
And we set the date that has been sort of at which, you know, we cut off, usually cut off abortions, has been set in the past. Why? But the point at which we thought the fetus was viable outside of the womb, not because of anything we knew about its intelligence or ability to feel pain. Is that right, Callum?
Yeah, so it was initially 28 weeks, I believe, in 1967, and I think in 1990 was reduced to 24, which, yeah, was pretty much the general thinking being around viability rather than anything else, I think.
Right. Well, we're going to take a quick break here. There's lots, obviously, to unpack. You're listening to Premier's Unbelievable with me, Roger Bolton, and my guests today are Dr. Callum Miller and Anne Faraday. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Premier Unbelievable, where we're discussing the topic of abortion. And my guests today are Dr. Callum Miller and Anne Faraday. If I can start again with you, Dr. Miller, and I don't want to obviously go into too much detail, but can you take us through what briefly an abortion involves? It obviously is different at various stages, but could you give us a very broad account of what the medical procedure is?
Yeah, so there are two broad kinds of abortion. And in medicine, we distinguish everything between medical and surgical. Surgical involving surgery of some kind, and medical basically meaning non-surgical. So medical abortions, I suppose, are roughly similar at every stage. It obviously depends because the baby changes size and so on. But they broadly involve taking a combination of pills, which breaks down the lining of the womb, therefore depriving the fetus of the nutrients and oxygen it needs to survive, and then causing contractions essentially to produce a miscarriage, or in a very late stage, you know, a stillbirth, basically the process of labor. In a surgical abortion, there are sort of two kinds. In the early stage, you would typically use a kind of vacuum, which essentially destroys the embryo or fetus by the strength of the vacuum and removes it. And at a later stage, after about 14 weeks or so, it would be called a dilation and evacuation, where instruments are put into the womb essentially to pull the baby apart piece by piece. And I wish I could make that more sanitary, but I think that is, you know, some people call these dismemberment abortions, other people say dilation and evacuation, but it essentially is pulling the fetus at this stage apart piece by piece. Those are, of course, the minority of abortions. But there are about 5% of abortions each year, those ones.
Obviously, this is deeply distressing for everyone involved. I noticed that I think about 20% of abortions take place in hospitals. The rest presumably take place in clinics where people feel, if not comfortable, are willing to carry these things out. I used a figure of 215,000 a year in England and Wales. Do we think now there are abortions being carried out outside of clinics, outside of hospitals? Because it was one of the arguments obviously made for legalizing abortion was it takes place anyway. Do you want to take place in circumstances where the woman has a decent chance of survival or not? Do we have any knowledge about how much, if you like, illegal abortion takes place?
Yeah, so we know that some illegal abortions take place. My understanding is that there are very few. I don't think there are many at all. What there has been a shift towards in the last couple of years since COVID especially is home abortions, where because if you have a medical abortion that just involves taking pills, it doesn't, in the most straightforward sense, need a doctor present to physically perform the abortion. Now, this has been probably one of Anne and I's sharper disagreements in the last couple of years, is whether that is safe, you know, sending the pills to a woman at home and then her taking the pills and having the abortion at home. My view is that there are serious safety problems with that. I know Anne would disagree very vehemently with that. But those are legal now. So this is not something that is being done without any sort of oversight. There is at least a conversation between a healthcare professional at the beginning.
And just dealing with the mother who has had the child aborted, there can be obviously physical damage and concerns, much less if it's carried out properly through a proper medical procedure. But what about the psychological impact of it on the person who would have been a mother? Have we got significant research which indicates long-term psychological consequences for that? Dr. Miller?
Yeah, so one of my research projects the last few years has been to do a real deep dive into the psychological effects of abortion and the mental health outcomes. And as you can imagine, this is furiously debated and very much controversial, so I'm not going to pretend that everything I say is, you know, the medical consensus. What I have concluded, though, from my look at this research is that the very best quality research suggests that for a woman with an unwanted pregnancy, if she has an abortion rather than continuing the pregnancy, she will have an elevated risk of anxiety, suicidality, drug abuse, and alcohol abuse. And that's if you take into account all of the pre-existing factors, the socioeconomic factors, previous mental health, and so on. I think the best research, which is in fact done by pro-choice researchers, does show that abortion has a worse outcome. Now, of course, Anne will maybe not make any claim about that, but will say it doesn't matter for the ethics. Of course, it matters for those women, but it doesn't matter for the ethics because it's still fundamentally the woman's choice. But on the other hand, of course, both Anne and I care about women. And, you know, if abortion does have these negative psychological effects, that's still important. And as I say, my conclusion from looking at the research is that it does have those significant negative psychiatric outcomes on women.
Thank you. Sorry. Let me come across to Anne Freddy at this point then. You've acknowledged conflicts of rights to life. You've acknowledged some at least of the psychological consequences of abortion and so on. But for you, these are, if you like, secondary, very important, but secondary to the overwhelming case. So what is the overwhelming case for abortion?
Well, for me, and it is why I titled the book that I did the way that I did. It's the overwhelming moral case here relates to the conscience rights that we accord to a pregnant woman. And the overwhelming case for it is to say that a woman is in a position where she is carrying the pregnancy physically, it's in her body, but she additionally, better than anyone else, knows her own circumstances and those of her family, and is able to make a decision about whether continuing the pregnancy and having a child, or whether ending the pregnancy before a child is born, is the right thing for her to do. And I think women think about it morally.
Your argument is that the only person who can make that decision is the mother, and that her right is to make that decision. Could I ask you, though, about, you know, in the past, arguments have tended to be often about young and married girls, 14, 15, things like that. It does seem now as if abortions are taking place a little later, say at 20, well, most, not all, of course, most at, say, 22, when some might think that women would be in a better position to maintain and look after a child. Could you give us some of the examples of the distress that women find themselves in, which makes them regrettably decide to have, in their view, I'm sure, to have an abortion?
Well, I think that the circumstances that we live in now, society-wide, expect far more of women. And women grow up in a society where they expect to be able to have a life that it is more than organizing themselves around their pregnancy. Now, you may think that that's a misdirection of priorities, or you may not. But
I don't understand why it necessarily involves abortion. It involves the relationships between the two people, the parents. Mm-hmm. And presumably, the way in which they organize their lives is up to them, but should acknowledge the need of women, or desire of women and need of women, to have a broader range of choice. It doesn't necessarily mean, does it therefore, that abortion is more necessary in your view? What is more necessary is a better balanced relationship between the two parents, if we can call them that.
Well, here we have problems, don't we? Because you talk about a better balance in the parents' relationship, and it's interesting to note that increasingly clinics see women who already have children and indeed are in long-term, stable, often married relationships who are terminating a pregnancy, they're having an abortion, not so that they can lead frivolous lives, but because they think that's the best way for them to be managing their family life. Now, you may think that that's a wrong way for them to go about it. I might think that it's the wrong way for couples to go about it. But ultimately, my kind of line in the sand always with abortion is who makes the decision. And why we can all of us have opinions about these things. Ultimately, there is one person who will live with the decision that she makes for the rest of her life, and that is the woman making it. Now, I think that abortion is a decision that's made in a moral context. I think that it's a decision that's made with a sense of responsibility. And I think, therefore, that we have to give women that choice. Of course,
but there is a problem, isn't there? The state has a view, has a right to have a view. In this sense, sounds rather cold-blooded, but we have an aging population. We aren't having enough children now. The burden on those children who have been born, in terms of taxation and everything else, is getting harder and harder. So it may be a selfish act, may it not, for older people and me, obviously, but young people as well, who've done pretty well out of society, who've got pretty well off on the whole, who expect younger people to support them one way or another, yet fewer of those young people are being born, and the burden on those who are born are getting greater. Surely the state has to bear that in mind, has to be concerned if the birth rate falls very significantly. You've got major problems in Italy, you've got major problems in Western Europe. Is that a secondary issue for you, a not important secondary issue?
Well, let's put it like this. I think that there are issues around personal autonomy and personal moral choice and the way that individuals can and cannot be compelled to do things, which I think, to my mind, are inviolable. I think there are then issues that the state can attack. I'm in Italy at the moment, and there's a massive concern about the reduction in the birth rate in what is predominantly a Catholic country. And there are things that the state can do, as indeed they have done in France, as they're doing in Hungary at the moment, to try and make it more acceptable to women to have children. But the bottom line is simply this. If a woman decides that she does not want to have this baby because it is the wrong time or the wrong circumstances for her to be able to do this, do any of us think that she should be forced to have that child for the good of the population or us older people? And I think that, you know, I would love to see more women welcoming maternity. I think having a child is one of the most remarkable and wonderful things that you can do. But that is a personal choice, and I don't think we can compel people to do that.
Well, sometimes in society we do say that individual freedom has to be constrained to protect the rights of others, but we will not pursue that one at the moment. Yeah. I want to pursue something with Callum Miller, though, which is a sort of reverse of the way that we normally do these things. Is let us assume that abortion is largely illegal. Let us assume fairly safely that people continue to have sex. Then what happens to these, in the case of 2021, 215,000 children now born who wouldn't have been born in England and Wales? Doubtless those who worry about depopulation are okay, but what about those children? What happens to them? What would society have to do? I wanted the last section to talk about whether there should be any change in the abortion laws, but if there were to be no abortions, and if all these children were to be born, some of course with significant life challenges physically as well as mentally, what would society have to do? How would we have to change?
This is a question that came up initially, you know, when abortion was being legalized. It was the huge question, what are we doing about all these, you know, unwanted children and so on? I think we now have pretty good empirical evidence, which says a few things. So firstly, it says that people will actually adapt their sexual behavior to some extent. So it's not as if people have sex in exactly the same ways with as many people, regardless of what policy there is. We know that when there are more consequences to sex, people are rational, especially women. Men might not be rational all the time, but women are. And they
We're
can
all irrational at certain points when it comes to this issue.
And so part of what you see is that actually people have less sex, or they use contraception better, and there are less pregnancies, which is a win-win outcome because no one is, you know, well, fewer people are facing unwanted pregnancies. Of course,
well, you'd presumably have to hope also the Roman Catholic Church changes its view about contraception, but that would be another question for another day. That's a big religious question, but I shouldn't go into it at this point. Carry on.
Well, in any case, I'm doubtful that many people listen to the Catholic bishops in England at the moment. The other thing you see is that when abortion is not available to women, and this has been seen particularly from a big study in the US in the last 10 years, it's not the case that most women abandon them or, you know, place them for adoption or whatever. Actually, most women, when they are faced with, you know, a child and they have to give birth to it, most women do end up looking after the child themselves. And so there's not going to be, you know, sort of a, you know.
Whether that's far too optimistic a view of human nature. I mean, there are images in our brains of the Romanian orphanages. There are images in our brains of the laundries in Ireland, of what happened to all those unwanted children were adopted elsewhere. And humanity's record is not great. And also, you're talking about Western Europe, or you're talking more widely. There has to be a question about how well we as a society would look after these children, would it not? I mean, I hope you're right. But are you? I just wonder whether you're too optimistic about that.
I think I'd say two things. The first is that Romania was a particularly unusual situation. They also banned the importation of contraception. They would do gynecological exams on women in factories to make sure that they were getting pregnant. And there were other, you know, draconian, wicked, sort of extremist pronatalist measures taken by Romania that made that problem particularly acute, which, of course, we wouldn't have in the UK, and no one mercifully is advocating for those sorts of horrendous things.
What about Ireland? To look at the example of Ireland, which we still don't know sufficient, and of course, as the importance of the Roman Catholic Church now diminishes, more and more evidence is coming out, which is particularly shocking. And the idea that this could only belong to the past would be an optimistic view of human nature, wouldn't it? Actually, it would be an unbiblical view, because the biblical view is that obviously we're all sinners and we all need to be redeemed, and we're not on a path to redemption at any other way than through our faith. So you're absolutely sure that something, if we'd got rid of abortion virtually altogether, that all these unborn children would be cared for?
I am actually pretty confident. And the reason I say that is because, you know, look, in the developing world still, where you have very high fertility rates, yes, there are still these problems. And maybe 50 years ago in Ireland, there would have been these issues of huge numbers of children placed for adoption or in the foster system or in orphanages and so on. The reality is that when you have contraception available in a developed world context and you ban abortion completely, like in Malta, you just don't have this problem. So in Malta, for example, abortion is not available for any reason at all legally. but they do not have, you know, they actually have the lowest fertility rate in Europe, or one of the lowest fertility rates in Europe, because most people use contraception. If there is a baby born in a difficult situation, fortunately, both the government and the pro-life sort of private movement have joined together to look after those women and children. And so I think that is what would happen. And of course, I strongly advocate for that to happen. I think when you look at a developed country context, like Malta or like Poland or like smaller countries like Liechtenstein, maybe, the fertility rate is low if you have contraception available, even if you have no legal abortion whatsoever. And I think that is the most realistic model for what would happen in the UK if, unrealistically, the UK were to seriously limit abortion.
I just want to push on one point further, if I may. The Roman Catholic Church on has a very coherent position on life issues. It all links together in terms of end of life as well. But actually on this issue, implicit in what you're saying is that those who wish to reduce or eliminate the abortion should certainly not be opposed to the wider introduction and use of contraception. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, wow. That's well, here's
well, it has to be a logical... Doesn't that have to be... The Roman Catholic Church in particular and opponents of contraception have to face up to that.
Well, so I think when you look at the evidence on what contraception access does to abortion rates, is really variable in a very strange way. And Anne can comment maybe at greater length than me on this. In some countries, like in Eastern Europe, where abortion was being used as contraception, the average Romanian woman used to have 8 abortions in her lifetime. When you introduce contraception into that context, of course, it reduces the abortion rate by a huge amount. In other countries where perhaps there isn't as much of a sort of sexual revolution, if you want to put it that way, the introduction of contraception can, on the one hand, prevent an individual act of sex leading to a pregnancy, but it can also cause what we call risk compensation, which is that you think, okay, now I'm safe, I can have a lot more sex. And so it increases sexual behavior. And so the effect of contraception on abortion access is actually sort of two-edged. And how that plays out overall really depends on many factors, including the culture of the country.
And Freddie, would you like to come in here? Have I been rather unfair in chasing up the Roman Catholic Church and its need to change its attitude to contraception if it wishes to maintain its approach to abortion?
Well, I want to build on the point that Callum was just making, because I think it's the most crucial one, which is that everything depends on the attitudes and the values of the country. And you can't really compare the UK to Malta or Poland or wherever, because the attitudes and the values that people have in the UK are generally profoundly different. And I think
but you're not making the case. You're not making the case that the moral case that this should only apply to the UK. You surely we're talking universal values here. You can't distinguish it that way, can you?
Universal values, and I would agree with you. However, I think it is profoundly the case now that in Britain, the argument that abortion is sinful and wrong is generally not accepted. And I think that the reason why abortion numbers, to go back to one of your first points, have risen has got a lot to do with what Callum just said about the dynamic between contraception and abortion, and that we now live in a society where for many people, they think that they should be able to control the number of children and the timing of them. And if contraception doesn't work, they see early abortion as an extension. And that's why the numbers have gone up, because abortion is available, it is safe, it is paid for by the state, it is very much intertwined with people's lives. Now, if we are going to change that, then we need to change attitudes profoundly to become more pro-family, more pro-child, more pro a whole number of other things, which you won't get just by banning abortion, because in a nutshell, you could make abortion utterly illegal tomorrow And what would happen is that it would still continue because women would buy their pills on the internet. What you really need to do is to construct a different kind of society if you want to construct different attitudes to fertility.
Well, if we can pause there, and I'm not sure we can reconstruct society in the third part of our discussion, but we'll have a crack at whether or not there are changes. We've discussed the principles of abortion, whether there are changes in the particular abortion laws at the moment that we might consider. Thank you very much for the moment. Anne Faridi and Callum Miller, back with you in a moment. Remember, you can always get in touch with us in the usual way, but we'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to the final part of our discussion on the rights of the unborn child, the rights of women, and the general abortion debate. You're listening to Unbelievable, and with us today is Anne Faridi and Dr. Callum Miller. Anne Faridi, we've been through in our discussions the rights of the child and the rights of the mother. We know that you feel that ultimately, though both have rights, the mother should be the decisive ones. Dr. Miller obviously disagrees with that and concentrates particularly on the rights of the child. Can I go in this final section to talk about whether there's anything in the existing laws that you, Anne Faridi, for a start, would like to see change? And then I'd come and put the same question to Dr. Miller. Are you broadly happy, Anne Faridi, with the laws as they exist in England and Wales in particular at the moment?
The law, in fact, is quite strict on paper. In that it says that abortion's illegal unless a woman meets certain circumstances, that and two doctors have to agree the request. But it's interpreted quite liberally by doctors. The majority of abortions are carried out because two doctors certify it's in the best interest of the woman's physical and mental health. They recognise the risks that would be incurred if women do have children, are forced to have them that they don't want. There's generally a time limit of 24 weeks unless there is a severe risk of anomaly, in which case that time limit can be passed, or indeed if the woman's interest is threatened. I would actually like to see abortion taken out of the criminal law altogether. I think that it is...
Sorry, let me get my head around that.
Sorry about that.
I'm a bit slow on that actual one. Does that mean that there would be no age limit on it, and so you would have abortion effectively on demand? Is that what would be the inevitable consequences of taking any possibility of criminal charges?
What it would mean to take abortion out of the criminal law is that it would still be governed by all of the laws that relate to medical practice, that it has to be done by qualified people in hospitals and so on. But whether or not a woman ends the pregnancy is a decision that's taken between her and her doctor. I'm a strong believer that doctors should have the right to conscientiously object to abortion if they don't want to participate in it. But if a doctor does feel that it's in a woman's best interest to end the pregnancy and she wants that, then I think it should be a matter between themselves. And the reason
just to check on that, no time limit at all?
Yeah, and the reason why I think there should be no hard and fast time limit is for this. One, I trust doctors and I trust women not to request abortions casually. In later
pregnancies.
No,
there's always somebody. I don't want to keep quoting, Dr. Harold Shipman here. There are bad doctors. Not many, I hope, I'm sure not. There are bad doctors. There are criminal doctors. There are evil doctors. Not many, but you don't need many, do you? If you're saying, I'll leave that entirely up to the doctor and the woman involved. None of us, surely, know what you know of human nature, none of us should be given that element of trust, should we? Because we're not worthy of it.
Well, you know, think about this then. In Scotland, there was no time limit at all until 1990, because the laws that in fact imposed a 28-week limit in England and Wales didn't exist in Scotland. And there were no later abortions in Scotland than there were in England and Wales, because women didn't request them and because doctors didn't have them. Now, I tell you what I have seen. I have seen someone come into a clinic at 24 weeks and one day, 24 weeks and 2 days, who have been unable to have an abortion that they would have been able to have perfectly lawfully 3 days earlier.
Yeah, that's the logic. The logic of that is then extend it, 26, 28. It's not get rid of it altogether. Are you saying that if a mother who thinks her due time is a week or 2 weeks away should have the right to have an abortion if she feels she's now can't bear the thought?
I don't think, do you really think that that's why women would request abortions? Do you really think that?
I don't know, but if there are no limits, you have to be absolutely sure that that wouldn't occur. And I just wonder whether that's too optimistic a view of human nature.
Well, I always think that I'm a profound cynic, but I cannot imagine in my wildest imaginings women and doctors colluding to carry out abortions at very late stages for no good reason. But what I can see...
Sorry, again, I don't want to intrude, but you will know, having studied the Nazi regime, that that's precisely what happened in the late 1930s and in the 1940s. It would only require a different change of regime for that sort of thing to occur again. We've seen in history it's happened.
Well, what I can say I think is absolutely wrong is what exists at the moment, where politicians who have no knowledge of an individual's personal circumstances are able to set parameters around medical procedures so that even when a doctor thinks that it's the right thing and even when a woman wants it, and I have to say the Nazis weren't terribly good on the rights of the individual, which are what underlay my thinking on this, the woman requests that the doctor carries it out. And I think that we should be in a position where we trust people to make these individual decisions for themselves without having politicians circumscribing when they can be carried out.
Well,
In Scotland, they managed it fine.
We elect politicians precisely to take some of these more difficult decisions. I just want to be absolutely sure I understand you. You are arguing now that there should be abortion on demand if the woman wishes it, if a doctor will provide it, and it shouldn't be constrained by any time limits or any other circumstances. Is that your position?
What I'm saying is that if a woman wants a procedure that is affecting most significantly her own life and her own body, and a doctor is prepared and thinks it's the right thing to do, that the decision should lie between themselves, and that politicians really have no part to play in this. Because I think that abortion is a personal, moral, and private decision between a woman and her doctor.
Now, Callum Miller, I guess that you would disagree with that, but could we go back and say, is there anything about the existing abortion laws that you would wish to have changed? We've heard in this program your moral concerns and objections to certain forms of abortion, but do you think that the present laws, as they are apply in England and Wales, need to be changed?
Yeah, there's a huge range of ways that I changed the laws, both in terms of addressing abortion directly, but also probably many laws that Anne and I again would agree on about making it less incredibly difficult for people to have children. especially at a younger age where many people are likely to become pregnant and maybe would want to have children if things weren't so difficult to do so at a younger age and to balance their life and their family. In terms of the abortion stuff particularly, I guess my view is, look, that the law allows effectively in practice abortion on demand up to 24 weeks, 6 months, and up to birth if the child has a disability. And as you rightly guessed, that's not something that I could in good conscience support, even anything like that. So I think it's easy to think of the law as being about punishment, but of course no one wants to punish for punishment's sake. And in fact, most pro-lifers don't advocate punishing the woman at all because of various different reasons, including the strain that she's often under.
If I understand your position, you're not opposed to all forms of abortion. So if you disagree with the existing law, what, as it were, is your bottom line? Which abortions would you allow, and how narrow would that range be?
So the law is first and foremost about protection. That's why we have it. And so from my perspective, this is about protecting unborn children and women. And my view, again, is that we have to have a basic principle of human equality, which means that we have the same principles in our law that protect an adult, as protect a child, as protect an unborn child. And what that means is that we cannot allow the ending of their life for any reason except in those situations where we would allow someone to end an adult's life. Those situations are extremely rare, but they don't depend on the adult's size or abilities or independence. It's really basically just if you need to end someone's life because they are posing a serious threat to your own life, i.e. self-defense, that is, in ordinary circumstances, the only real situation in which we would allow someone to take the life of another adult. My view is just that human equality demands the same principle for unborn children.
If you find the child is going to be very, very disabled, then society has to ensure the child is born and looked after properly. As far as I can see, you're only putting forward when the mother is threatened, her life is threatened, is, in your view, the only circumstance in which you would think abortion was appropriate. And that would be because, in principle, you were trying to save life.
Yeah, exactly. And what you can see here is that Anne and I have pretty much the two most polar opposite views. And what I think that shows about the debate, those actually become the pretty much the most plausible views. It's quite rare in the academic...
No fudges on this one.
It'll be hard to find a middle ground because ultimately the question is this a child that has all the same rights, including all the same protections as an adult human being, which is, you know, a pretty extreme set of protections that we give to everyone else? Or is this the woman's choice, in which case her choice has to be paramount, no matter how developed the child is, no matter how far along it is? And so what you see is that although both of us look like we have sort of extreme views, I think these two are actually by far the most plausible views. And so for me, again, it's fundamentally a question of equality. We would not end the life of an adult just because they had a severe disability. We would not end the life of an adult if they had been conceived in sexual crime, for example. And it really is just an application of human equality that says it might be difficult to do this, and we have to give the utmost support to women in these profoundly, you know, horrendous situations. But ultimately, if we really believe in human equality and human rights, we have to apply them consistently. We really don't have many other options.
Well, I didn't start this discussion with the naive hope that I would enable you to agree with each other all the way through and somehow produce a magic solution. But I just want to pick up one thing, Callum, which is the consequence of your position is criminalization of women. If you are actually going to do, as you suggest, vastly, vastly reduce abortion to a very small number of cases, human experience would tell us that there will be still a significant number of abortions. They will be carried out by frequently unqualified people, or maybe people will do abortion tourism or something like that. But the state will be saying these women are criminals. And if they do that because it's against the law, there will have to be penalties of some sort. Do you really want to be in a position where you're criminalizing these women who are often in a state of great distress or driving them abroad?
I think it's a very fair question, and I think pro-lifers often sort of run away from it and pretend that there's no even superficial problem here. And I think clearly there is. It's a perfectly fair question. It's one that I answer in detail on my website, so I'll share that later. my view is that there's a very good reason for a presumption of non-culpability. So when we look at anything that is against the criminal law, we think not only was someone's rights violated, was the criminal law broken, but also how culpable were they? We don't punish five-year-old children for doing things that are wrong, even if it was really badly wrong. I think there's a really good reason for the strong presumption of non-culpability. There's a number of reasons. Often women are not told about all the details of what abortion involves, the development of the child. Now, they often know a lot about it, I think often don't know some important facts about it. Secondly, most women are under intense strain, either by their circumstances or by someone else. So they might be coerced by another person, or they might be under such extreme pressure from their circumstances that that removes some of the culpability. And also, of course, for 50 years in England and Wales and Scotland, the law itself has told women this is morally and legally permissible. And of course, no one thinks that people should be criminalized for doing something that the law allows them to do.
And if a law is not going to be enforced, then it's pointless having the law, and you bring the rest of the law into disrepute because you're saying, well, this is law, but don't bother about it. So you're saying essentially there are three parties, you would say, the doctor, the unborn child, and the mother. If you're saying that it's unlikely or unnecessary to pursue the mother because of the circumstances involved, that still leaves you with the doctor, the person who's carrying out this process. Now, the law, to have any value, would have to involve prosecuting doctors for breaking it.
Yes, and for people who are not in that situation of the woman, then I would support some sanctions. The easiest way to think through this is an analogy. So we ban already infanticide. And if you take your baby to a doctor in a hospital and say, I would like my baby to be killed because I can't look after it or because it's disabled, and the doctor goes ahead and kills it, what do you do? Now, no one wants to see people punished for the sake of it. No one wants to see people punished. And a key part of the law and jurisprudence is the exceptionally difficult balance of how to protect the basic rights of people and then how to enforce that. And enforcement is always tricky because you don't want to punish people. I don't want people to be punished, but at the same time, I want protection. But that is not a problem that is unique to abortion. That is a problem with enforcing any criminal law.
Oh, well, hold on. These are particular difficult emotional and moral issues. And a lot of people would worry about introducing a law and really leaving it up to the legal authorities to decide whether to enforce it or not, or with whom, and criminalizing large numbers of doctors who may be faced with extreme moral issues. Parliament would really run a mile from introducing a law like that, because if you can't enforce a law, you bring law generally into disrepute. And I have real difficulty in seeing how you would now enforce a law as relatively complete as you're proposing. How would your medical colleagues react to this, do you think?
I would apply the same principles as with many other parts of criminal law. It might be euthanasia, where many people do it out of compassion. Many doctors might be inclined to do it out of compassion and so on. But we recognize that euthanasia is not legal and that if you break the law, there has to be some penalty. Now, penalties come in very different kinds. It might be you have restrictions on your practice. It might be you lose your ability to practice. It might be that you have an economic penalty. It might be that you go to jail. This is really to illustrate that the law isn't always as black and white as we might expect it to be. Actually, there are ways of balancing protection of people's basic rights with mechanisms of enforcement that are sensitive to issues such as culpability, motivation, you know, good character, and so on. And so, yes, I agree with you. The law has to be clear. If we want no sanctions for women at all, that should be in legislation. And then there should, as with any other law, there should be an explanation of what is, for example, the maximum penalty that someone performing an abortion might receive. But at the same time, as with any other law, there is also flexibility within the judicial system, because part of being a good judge is figuring out these complex issues of motivation, culpability, and so on, And that's an inevitable part of enforcing any law.
At this point, I think you are further apart than you were at the beginning, or I thought you were at the beginning, while remaining friends, which is a considerable triumph. Let me congratulate you. But what I gather from all of this is that there's not a cat in hell's chance of British Parliament wanting, if they can do it, to get involved in this area at all. So we're probably, except a relatively small number of people. So I think we're in the situation we're in. Granted that, Anne Faraday, and granted the fact that you obviously don't believe in abortions, you believe there may be a necessity, but you obviously believe that it was better that they could not. What could we do to reduce the number of abortions while retaining women's right to choose?
I think there will always be a need for abortions, but I do think that we live in a peculiarly hypocritical society at the moment that wishes to, on the one hand, demonize the choice of ending a pregnancy, whilst at the same time providing very few options for people who do genuinely want to carry that forward. What I would like to see is a society where women are actually able to exercise a real and genuine choice, where the only abortions that take place because women are in a situation where they are saying that there are no material circumstances that are pushing them in that direction. Think about the fact that in Britain we live in a society that imposed a cap on child benefit, that if you have three children and you have a fourth child, then you no longer get state support, an increase in state support for that. I'm not suggesting that the majority of women have abortions because they can't afford to have children. That would be a facile thing to argue. But at the same time, there is this tension. And I think that one of the things that is very difficult for young women to imagine at the moment is how they can have a full family life and at the same time have a life at work or in politics. And the more we could move towards balancing that, the better it would be for society. Don't know whether it would affect abortion rates, but it would be the right thing to do.
I don't want to suggest you're a conservative, Callum, although some would describe your position as being conservative. There is a big push from parts of the political spectrum about more family-friendly policies on the one hand. And yet that section of society would be appalled by the idea that you should have greater sex education and more easily available contraception and so on. So in a way, if we are going to wish to reduce abortion, are we going to have to move forward on those two fronts, try and construct family-friendly policies and also increase the amount of sex education that is available? And that's very difficult politically. I mean, is that naive of me to suggest those are two things that we really should focus on?
Well, I don't know how big the part of society pushing for family-friendly policies is. At least they're not having much impact, sadly. I'm sort of in the middle of the political spectrum. I'm economically pretty left-wing, socially relatively conservative, pro-taxes, pro-welfare, pro-immigration, etc., pro-environmentalism. And so for me, you know, the ruling party for the last 13 years has been pretty much the worst government imaginable. They've been economically heartless and socially progressive.
Well, if we're going to take these moral positions, it's not enough. In order to help people not to face such difficult moral decisions, there's a range of things as a society we have to look at outside of this relatively narrow question of abortion.
Well, absolutely. So I would love to see any party, whoever it is, take real concrete steps towards supporting families, supporting parents, making it so less terribly difficult for people to even imagine having a child until they're well into their 30s. And I think there are so many things that can be done, such as removal of the benefit cap that Anne mentioned, such as home care allowances that would pay women who look after their children, because that is labor, that is work, and it's unrecognized work that has a disproportionately negative impact on women, because their work and their labor in the home or in childcare is simply treated as not work, as if it didn't involve any effort. There are many, many other things. So what I would say as a caution is that the impact on the abortion rate might be limited by some of that. I think it would reduce the abortion rate somewhat, but it wouldn't be game changing. It would modestly reduce the abortion rate. Sex education is a whole other question. It really depends on the kinds of sex education. If it's the kind of sex education that some of the sort of far left groups promote, where they're teaching 4-year-olds to masturbate, sorry to say it, but that's what's in the curricula, I don't think that's going to reduce the abortion rate. I think that's going to sexualize young children and cause unwanted pregnancies.
Sorry, Karen, to interrupt you. We've come to the end of our discussion almost, but I must give Anne the last word. And did I, my eyes mislead me, Anne, or did I see you nodding greatly at a lot of things Callum said in his last answer?
Well, I think it's true. I honestly think the only thing that is going to impact on the abortion rate is if you can bring society to an understanding that it is morally wrong for a woman to end her pregnancy. And I really do not think that modern Western civilized society is in a position where it will believe that.
Anne Faraday, Callum Miller, thank you very much. I'd love to hear from our listeners what they think, particularly about that last statement, which is almost the beginning of another discussion. Thank you both very much for talking to us and to talk to us in such an open and friendly and honest way. And, well, we have to leave it there. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. And as always, let us know what you think. And also tell us what you'd like us to discuss next time. Until then, goodbye.
That was Roger Bolton signing off from this week's Unbelievable. I do hope you enjoyed that discussion between Anne Faraday, author of The Moral Case for Abortion, A Defence of Reproductive Choice, and Dr. Callum Miller, a doctor, philosopher and ethicist. We would love to know what you made of the show. Please do drop us an email at unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or you can get in touch via our social media at UnbelievableFE for Twitter, or head over to the Premier Unbelievable Facebook page. And of course, you can find links to all of our shows, articles and other content on our website, premierunbelievable.com. And if you register for free on our website, it will give you access to all of the website's content, as well as a subscription to the Premier Unbelievable newsletter, through which we will send you hours of exclusive bonus material and resources. It will also give you access to a plethora of free ebooks, extra video content from The Big Conversation, and much more. That's premierunbelievable.com. Thank you for listening, and do join us next week for another Unbelievable, the show that aims to get you thinking.